Welcome to Galley Tables, sharing stories and sharing life. Each month, Galley Table Storytelling hosts a live event in the Kodiak community. Storytellers are given 7 minutes to tell a personal story related to a monthly theme. Tonight, we're going to hear those stories.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Galley Table. We are so happy to see you for our event tonight. The next theme is whether or not, and we have some really amazing stories for you. So we're so glad that you came out because there were so many things to do tonight.
So again, our theme tonight is whether or not. Now we can welcome our first storyteller today, who is Brian Earl Large, also known as B. Large. He considers himself lucky to be born and raised in Kodiak, eating seafood and using the omega-3 fatty acids to make him fish smart. B practices awesomeness every day, his cello every other day, and walking his cat to the brewery every couple of weeks. He enjoys karaoke singing, improv theater, considers himself a fly-by-the-seat-of-his-pants kind of guy, and is currently looking to form an improv troupe with like-minded folks. A legend in his own mind, ladies and gentlemen, B. Large.
Well, that was just one song from the early 90s. This takes place when I was in junior high. It was, that dates myself. Early 90s, okay? And it was great. MC Hammer. He could have had a lot of money if he made his own pants line. Those pants were, he would have paid for all his dancers and everything. We're just, if he could just sew some pants. Everybody loved those pants. I loved them because I loved sweatpants in junior high. I had many different kinds of sweatpants. I wore red sweatpants, pink t-shirt. That was mostly, but everybody did, I think. So I was kind of a bad boy in junior high. Got detention a lot. Some in-school suspension, which is really bad. So this time, I actually went on recess and de-pantsed people. It was about 20 people in recess, and I know you can't do that now, but early 90s, it was okay. You just got 3 in-school suspension days. And first couple days, I just had to sit in this little cubicle, and the teachers brought me, the homework. And the last day was an assembly day. And so everyone piled in to the high school and watched the Air Force Band play all these awesome cover songs. And, I had to sit with the vice principal. Going in there, I was escorted in and sat right next to her. But let me get back to the pants part. Okay? I would go on these wrestling trips to the mainland, and my mom would go with me, and we'd go to Joanne Fabrics. She said, "Go ahead and pick your fabric. I'm gonna make you MC Hammer pants. Purple pants with the lightning bolt and some zigzags." So I was the only one with those MC Hammer pants, so I knew how cool I was in junior high. I probably wore them to the assembly, I don't remember. I just remember Moni Moni was playing. That's my jam. And the vice principal, which later on, when I got of drinking age, I actually was served a drink from her. And so it was actually the coolest vice principal in junior high ever. I didn't realize that. We actually did a little improv too last year. And so I know, but she was sitting there and she just turned to me and said, "Brian, this is really boring. And we need somebody to get up there and dance." And whether or not she was serious, I didn't ask her. I just jumped off the stage and I came right up onto the stage and the Moni was playing, so I was like, well, here's my jams. I'm sure it was a little different than that. I think I could do the worm a little better, you know, with a little more rubber. Anyway, the Air Force band guy came up and he said, wow, that kid has more moves than a halibut. And yeah, I'm taking that quote with me everywhere. I do, I get this right stretching out. And everyone was pretty surprised because it was Moni Moni and then this kid just doing his thing. And then everyone watched me go back and sit next to the vice principal. And she thought, and everyone was like, whoa, did he just get in trouble again for dancing? So on my way back to my locker, after the whole band came up, the announcement came on. There was one announcement over the whole intercom that said, Brian Large is not in trouble for dancing.
She moved to Kodiak a year and a half ago from South Korea, where she was teaching abroad. She missed nature and wanted to be back where the skies were big and the trees were tall. She's a seventh grade language arts teacher at the middle school who spends her days drinking copious amounts of coffee while finding joy in sarcastic, silly 12-year-olds. When she's not busy teaching, you can find her lifting heavy things at CrossFit, hiking with her husband and three dogs, playing board games, or rewatching Parks and Rec for the 50th time.
And I'm growing up in Girdwood, Alaska. And if you don't know anything about Girdwood, it's about 45 minutes south of Anchorage and about an hour away from Seward. And Girdwood is known for the Alaska Ski Resort, which is pretty well known, and the Girdwood Forest Fair, where the only rules are no religion, no politics, no dogs. It's filled with deadheads who are ski bums and they just love peace. Thank you. Okay, so it's Girdwood and it's winter and it's snowing a lot, and this year we've gotten extra amount of snow, and then we have this really weird warm weather time, and then we get even more snow, and what happens is it causes a huge, just a massive avalanche on the Turnagain Arm, which is already windy and dangerous, and it's the only road that connects you from Anchorage to Girdwood. This avalanche covers part of the Turnagain Arm, and it takes out 7 gigantic power lines that provide power for not only Girdwood, but for Hope and Whittier and Portage. So these 4 smaller towns are totally without power. The only road that could bring in any gas, any food, you can't get to Girdwood now anymore. So people are freaked out, reasonably so, because these power lines are covered under all the snow, which is on top of the road, and you get the point. So one restaurant in town, which is kind of like the Henry's of Girdwood, kind of the restaurant I grew up in, they realized that they can still stay open and they can still serve 2 beautiful, wonderful things, pizza and beer. So they tell the community, and this community just fills up Chair 5. And they have candles throughout the whole restaurant, as well as lanterns, and the best part is that all of the staff, the wait staff, and the chefs are all wearing those like silly little hiking headlamps. And they're taking your order, and the pins you see, they got the pad and the headlamp, and you can hardly see the people you're sitting with, but they stay open, and they have musicians come, and the whole restaurant is just packed with people, and it's just got such wonderful atmosphere. And people are really happy, and for one night they can forget that there's no heat in their house and that they're not going to be getting out of Girdwood anytime soon, and it's just really wonderful. And day 2, still no power, still Chair 5 is open, and people come and they relax And morale was kind of down here. And then when they realized they don't have to go to work and they don't have to go to school and the only really good restaurant in town is open and they're serving pizza and beer, everybody's pretty happy about this situation all of a sudden. And then something really bad happens. Day three, Chair 5 realizes that they're quickly running out of pizza ingredients and they're quickly running out of beer. And the power is still out. Now I know what you're thinking, like, oh no, this is the end of the story, everybody's sad and nobody survives through this power outage. But I kid you not, they literally got a helicopter flown from Anchorage filled with pizza ingredients and kegs of beer, and they flew it that 45-minute journey to Girdwood so they could get Chair 5 that ingredients and beer. And people are suddenly extremely happy, and they are very happy that there's a power outage, and they can't get to work, and they can't go to school, and everything's really good. And so it's day three, and we're back at Chair 5, and we're having dinner, and we're drinking beer, and everything's great, and we're still using candles and headlamps. Day four, same thing. Day five, the power comes back on. And people are pretty bummed. So imagine like our power outages, you know, last week, but this time it's like, oh man, I gotta go back to work, and I don't have an excuse to drink a lot of beer and eat a lot of pizza. And so when I heard that the theme was whether or not, I thought of this story, and I thought that, you know, there's this community in Girdwood where everybody managed to get together and make this really crappy situation okay, and whether or not they have power, I realized that pizza and beer can make any situation okay.
Our next storyteller is Sperry Ash, and he's got a really wonderful bio, and I think that Sarah is making me read it because it has words that are very hard to pronounce in Russian. So, Sperry Ash was born in Homer, Alaska, but raised mainly in Manwaluk, formerly known as English Bay. He came to Kodiak to be a seminary student at St. Herman Seminary. He had been an elementary teacher in Akichuk, and his wife's village on the Kuskokwim for a few years, but now being a full-time student at his main job. He does crafts such as weaving and carving to bring income to the family, and some of his work is for sale at the Java Flats Cafe. I think I saw that a couple weekends ago. Yeah, it's really awesome. You guys should go get some of this stuff.
Check it out,
it's very Ash. His wife is Michelle George, and they have four kids. His parents and extended family, the Kvasnikovs, live in Anwalik, and the Ash clan lives in California. Sperry says, Kodiak has been so welcoming to us. Kids love the school. We enjoy discovering your beaches and trails. We enjoy the many community events like this. Kuyana, thank you, Galley Tables, and Kuyana Kodiak.
I very much respect storytelling, and I was happy to learn about this event, and it's an honor to be here to present. I'll do my best with that. Actually, the only Russian word was the family last name.
Yeah.
All the other words are Aleutik and Yupik. And that brings me to my start. In Aleutik, we call weather Tha. And thaw can have all kinds of different meanings as well, besides weather. It could mean awareness. It also means environment, your environment, surroundings, and it's the word for universe. So when I think of the word weather or thaw, it kind of has this whole collection of ideas. And being raised in Nunavik, some of our teachings tell us about thaw. And thaw, one of them is not to talk badly about Tha. That they say that Tha has good ears and can hear what we say. And if it's offended in any way, it'll turn on you. And so I think it helps to create a good positive look towards Tha and what Tha brings to us, the weather. There's an ancient story that tells about an Ayanaha, a young girl who was starting her first year menstruation cycles. And she carelessly spoke outside and she offended Tha, and it caused a lot of problems. And I think when I hear the story, you could almost say that's Ice Age. So, but the story doesn't have it has a good ending for all of us, but not a good ending for her. But that's not my story for tonight. It's only my example that demonstrates that these stories and teachings tell us that love is the boss. Weather is the boss. It dictates for us, as you all know, our travel, all our work outside. That hasn't changed from traditional times to today, right? I mean, it's something we're all familiar with. So that hasn't changed, you know. But some things that has changed is, for example, in travel, you know, dependent on weather, from sleek kayaks to modern day airplanes flying in the sky. This is something our ancestors prophesized, even say these things will be seen, we'll experience them in our time, and this is what we see. And that's the beginning of the stories that I want to tell. I don't know how I'm doing on time. So Nanaalik, the town where I'm from, it's a remote area. It can't be reached by driving. It has to be reached by a small airplane on our airstrip that is basically part of the beach. It's a crooked runway, and it's in between a cliffside and the village itself. And there's that strip of land, and planes zoom in and zoom out every hour on the hour in Nanaalik, weather permitting. Yeah. So, but you can imagine with all that travel, there are many accidents have happened. My younger sisters, a few years ago, they took a crash landing into the ocean. I guess the plane was trying to take off, and it realized it didn't have enough lift to clear the cliffs. So the pilot made the decision to go in the water. But they survived. They survived, they swam to shore. The pilot, he didn't know how to swim, so they swam back to get him. But they all made it. And other stories, and I'm sure you have your own stories too about how close calls or some that were just very unfortunate. My cousin, they had an emergency landing on a small beach on a little island, and she was pregnant at the time, and they lost their 8-month-old baby. That was tough for her, but all the others survived. My dad had an experience where they were flying from Nanaalik, him and my aunt and the pilot, they were flying all the way to Anchorage, and the engine died on them mid-air. He said everything went silent, and they started to tilt down. And the pilots, I don't know how to fly. I don't know. I've flown in planes all my life. I don't know how to take those. I need to learn. But anyway, so he's pumping something. He got the engine boiling. They got it. In you go. So all these kind of experiences demonstrate that's the 2-minute, right? So demonstrate that travel can be very risky and very dangerous, and we've got to be careful. And that relationship with love, you have to have your awareness and your wit about you, recognize your surrounding and environment, right? So my story, 2 minutes. I'm flying from Homer to Nanaalik. It was a winter day, very stormy, strong gusts, but you know, I had to get home. Where am I gonna stay in Homer if I spend the night in Homer? Gotta get home. So the pilot agreed to go, and there we go, and I'm looking down below, and the water is just rough as ever, really. And the plane is being tossed around really hard, really bumpy. I felt like a little kid was just holding the plane and doing this with us, you know, and it's just tough. Now, of course, I'm starting to say my prayers, so this is it. And I pray, and then at the end of my prayer, I just said, God, if this is it, quit. Let it go, just go. And of course, at that moment, we hit an air pocket. And I'm like, no! I changed my mind. Yeah, so pilot catch me. And he starts focusing, coming towards that airship. We made it. I live to tell the tale. Thanks to God, I live to tell the tale. But my weather or not moment, actually, it's also a moment of getting to know chance meeting. What was last year's
chance
encounter? Was with my true self. I realized that's not what I can do. But whether or not, let's all travel safely. Let's always be aware and keep that in mind as we continue our journey wherever we may go. Hoyara.
Our last storyteller before intermission is Kaden Jetty. He was born and raised in Jacksonville Beach, Florida, where he was a member of the Ocean Rescue before enlisting in the Coast Guard in 2013. Kaden received orders to the Coast Guard cutter Spar in the summer of 2016 and has been loving Kodiak ever since. Sorry, I didn't realize I wasn't in the microphone. He is fond of long walks on the beach and a romantic candlelit slice of pizza. So welcome, Kaden.
What's going on, everybody? Thanks to everybody that showed up for me. You're all great. So this story takes place back home in Jacksonville Beach, Florida. It's my senior year of high school, and it really makes me kind of look like an idiot. So it's about 2 months before prom, and I notice everybody starts pairing up, and I'm like, oh man, I really gotta get in on this. So I ask out the hottest girl in school, right? Because, of course, she would want to go out with the hottest guy in school. Well, she turned me down, but that was fine. So I was sitting in math class, and I turn around to my friend Angie, and we're just talking, and she's like, oh man, I'm looking for somebody to go out to prom with. And I'm like, oh, why not me? She was like, sure, there's nothing romantic about it, but you know, rather go with friends than go alone. Fast forward about 2 weeks, and I'm on a class trip with my ex-girlfriend. And this is really where it gets bad. My ex-girlfriend was excellent at crocodile tears, right? Getting sad and weepy just to get what she wants. It was super manipulative, and I fell for it so hard, okay? So of course, she starts talking and she, oh, I wanted to get together with you, and I was like, okay. yeah, you wanna go to prom? And then I was like, oh no, I've got 2 dates to prom. Is this an 80s sitcom? What is going on? So I had to make a decision whether or not to go out with Angie or my ex-girlfriend. And I made the incorrect decision, I went out with my ex-girlfriend. Don't do that if you're in high school crowd. Just, no. So, you know, you do all the regular prom stuff, you get an ill-fitting tuxedo and flowers and all that jazz. And we show up to prom, and it is the most awkward event in the world. The lights are on the dance floor, and trust me, if you're full of hormones and a teenager, that's the worst scenario to be in. And it's just awkward, and of course, teenagers don't drink. I wasn't drinking, but my ex-girlfriend started drinking heavily. She snuck some alcohol into the dance, and I drove. And I was like, oh man, she's getting messed up. I'm gonna leave. But before I leave, I notice Angie is hanging out with a bunch of friends, a different guy than me, and she just looks like she's having a good time. She's laughing about how bad the dance is and everything. And yeah, so should have picked her. But so I'm driving home, and this is where it gets real bad. I get pulled over because I'm a dumb teenager and I was speeding and probably running stop signs and doing whatever the heck I wanted to do. And keep in mind, this is North Florida. This isn't exactly Kodiak, so not all the police were super understanding of kids with silly funny names like I did. My middle name is Hawaiian. And so I get pulled over, give them my ID, give them my registration and everything, and she's drunk. So she starts cursing out this police officer. This doesn't look very good for me. So, of course, you know, he runs my license and all this, and he's like, son, step out of the car. And I'm like, oh, man, I don't want to go to jail. I'm 16 years old, and I really don't want to go to jail. And he sits me in the back of the cop car, and he looks at me, and he goes, hey, man, are you drunk? And I'm like, no, like, you can breathalyze me. I'm not drunk. So he breathalyzes me, and I come up 0.0. And he's like, she's drunk though. I'm like, yeah, take her away. Yeah, she's messed up.
I really hope she doesn't see this, by the way.
Anyways, he's like, all right, I'm gonna search your truck. And I was like, okay. So he searches my truck, and she's still cursing this guy out. I mean, she is just F you, F this. I'm like, oh my gosh. Like, she's going to jail. So finally, the cop pulls me out of the back of the car, and he's like, hey man, you're going straight home, right?
I was like, of course, yes sir, yes officer.
And he's like, do you care if I mess with her a little bit? And I was like, oh, I don't care, go ahead. So I mean, he did the whole 9 yards. It wasn't just get in the back of the cop car. It was hands on the hood, put your get on the ground, like the whole 9 yards. I was loving it. I wish I had recorded it or something. Like, it was amazing. But I didn't. And honestly, I drove home. And I just thought about it. I was like, man, I really should have gone with Angie. So I hit her up, and I hit my buddies up, and they all end up at the same little party after prom, because everybody left prom early, because prom's kind of lame. And you know, so I show up at this house, because I didn't go straight home. Sorry, police officer. And just had a great time with her afterwards. She was just out with a friend, and it was a good night. So whether or not you need to get your ex-girlfriend arrested, you should probably do it. Thank you.
Storyteller. It is of secondary significance where Daria Safronova was born. What matters is where she's going, and of that she is not yet aware. Kodiak is her haven after a lengthy pilgrimage, is a place from which one day she will launch another journey. For a living, she tells stories at various educational institutions. Her hobby is life. It takes up all her free time. She loves silence. Please welcome Daria.
Hello everyone. So guys, let's not forget what the day is today. It's spring break. So my story is about how exactly 8 years ago, I took a journey west. And at that point in my life, I lived in Ohio. So imagine the last day of school, I'm renting a car, Kia Compact. And it's the third time in my life driving a car. And I have a quintessential American dream. I want to head west. So I packed the car with Walmart snacks, sleeping bag, you know, I'm cheap. And an item of St. Xenia. I buckled her up in the passenger seat. I think I'm safe. I just want to head west. So Ohio ended fast. Indiana flew by. Illinois flew by as well. Iowa was heavily flooded. That was okay. That's the beauty of the American dream. You can go south, you can go north, you can go east, west. So I figured it out. Nebraska was dangerous. Cops sitting at every corner on the dark roads, catching the small Ohio fish on, can you imagine? Where is justice? South Dakota was sandy, no snow though. Finally, I hit Iowa. I hit Wyoming. So here I am. I'm only a couple of hours away from my dream. I'm going Yellowstone. But suddenly, on the radio, they start saying, the parkway is closed, snow-packed. No way to get to Yellowstone. I said, well, how's it possible? No snow around. I said, well, the parkway is closed. So I turn south. And I hit Thermopolis, a small town with a hot spring in the middle of it. So I get into that hot spring, and I start walking around. Those of you who have never been in a hot spring, it's not like a China hot spring. It's like a small hole, and you're supposed to walk around in a borrowed swimming suit, because you know who takes along a swimming suit on a road trip. And it's like waist deep. And there's only one elderly couple walking around in that hot spring. And he'll walk around and around and around, and eventually they come up to me and say, well, where is home? And I told them, well, Ohio. And I said, well, where are you heading? I said, well, I was heading to Yellowstone, but now I guess I'll just turn and head back east, and 5 days I have to be back to school. And suddenly the man has like this malicious twinkle in his eye. Now that I'm saying it's malicious, I still can't figure it out whether it was malicious, adventurous, whatever it was. And he tells me, you know what? There is no way you can head back east without having seen the Teton Mountains. Well, I've never heard the name Teton Mountains, you know, I'm not local. His wife like, shows him in the side and says, seriously, look, the weather is gathering up. She cannot get to Teton Mountains, because whether or not, she has to see the Grand Teton Mountains. Well, my mom always said, whenever you want her to do something, just tell her not to do that. Of course, I decided to head west again to see the Grand Teton Mountains. Well, I'm heading west, and I see that there are some cars going east, but there are no more cars going west, and the clouds are gathering up. The sky is getting darker and darker. So, well, the man's local. There is no way he would have sent me in a small Kia compact car somewhere in a dangerous situation. So I pass, suddenly I see like a roadside souvenir store. I stop by, and there's an elderly couple. I'm getting suspicious right there. They ask me, where is home? Home is Ohio, but I'm heading west to see the Grand Teton Mountains. And they say, well, the weather is gathering up. So, well, that's okay, I'll get there. Say, well, why don't you stay with us, and our son is coming here soon. And as I said, all those westerns rush to my head. You know, I don't want to stay with them in that souvenir store, which is dark and filled with all that souvenir stuff. So I'm heading to the mountains. And here I go, and the road, I passed the last town, and the road starts getting up. And it starts snowing, like this. And I'm in blissful ignorance of studded tires, all drive. I just push the button and it drives, you know, the car. So I keep going up and up. It kind of gets like, kind of, I have to push it really hard. Well, but I'm going up. Once I pass the crest, it starts on the other side of the mountain. It starts snowing even heavier. And suddenly I realize I have no control of the car. I start sliding. I don't know how many miles I kept sliding down and down and down. Seeing me in the passenger seat was shaking. I was shaking. I was saying, God, please, not here, not on the slope of Grand Teton Mountains. Not here, compact, please. And I'll be good. I'll never go to Teton Mountains again. Whether or not, I will not. I don't know how many miles down. You can imagine, it's like a dead man's curb. That's how it was. All the way, cliff on one side, precipice on the other side. 25 miles down or so, that's, this distance doesn't matter, of sliding, with my chin shaking uncontrollably, my hands shaking, I reached some kind of roadside hotel. I can barely make it out of the car. I get to the counter, and a nice girl, not an elderly couple, looks at me, produces a jug of whiskey from under the counter, puts a tumbler on the counter, and says, before you start speaking. But, to tell the truth, I couldn't even drink that. That's how my teeth were shaking. In retrospect, thinking whether I should have taken the road to Teton Mountains or not, I think, whether or not.
I feel like all of us might have an interesting story like that when we leave here tonight, so please be careful. Our next story is Mark Anderson. Mark Anderson was found on top of a haystack on a farm in South Dakota in a family with four sisters. After receiving a bachelor's degree from Bethel University in St. Paul, Minnesota, he moved to Nome, Alaska in 1983. In 1985, he moved to Minnesota but soon realized Number one, how much you miss Alaska. And number two, if he stayed much longer, he would end up spending 9,256 hours of his life commuting. So he packed up his Mazda pickup and drove the Alpine in 1987, arriving in Anchorage at the tail end of Alaska's 80s economic crisis. He met Andrea, his first week in town, and it only took him 3 years to convince her to marry him. In 1992, he was hired at First National Bank, Alaska, and shortly thereafter was appointed the branch manager in Seward. Three children, Anna, Jonas, and Baxter, were born in Seward. In 1998, Mark accepted the Kodiak branch manager position. The Anderson family moved to Kodiak in 1998 while leaving a company vehicle on the departure ramp, doors wide open, keys in the ignition, and engine running, but the family arrived here unscathed. Awesome. In 2014, Mark was invited to join a partnership which formed Brecken Construction. He remains there as CFO of the construction company and also Brecken Family Assets. Welcome to the stage, Mark Anderson.
Good evening. It was the first week of November of 2006, and I was sitting in my chair at the desk at the bank, and my friend Brian Young stepped through the door and kind of looked at motioned at me and said, "Is it all clear?" And I motioned him into my office, and we started talking. And he said, "Hey, I got one last Halibut trip this fall, and kind of looking for a half share guy." And I'm thinking, "Oh, he's going to ask me." And he says, "Do you know anybody?" And I pretended to not know anyone, and then I said, "Hey, how about me?" And he said, "Yeah, that might work out." So a day later or two, he calls and he says, "Yeah, we got you on the program, and you're coming." So I went home and I checked the weather, and looked at the weather. We were going to go down to Area 3B, and it was calling for 2-foot seas in the shallow coffin. I told my wife, because my wife was very worried about this, and I said, we'll be fine. So we jump on the boat. The first thing, one of the crewmen meets me coming out of the galley with a 5-gallon bucket, and he says, "The head's broken." So not a good start. And about 9 hours later, I find myself doing the first wheel wash, and it's 9 a.m. We're heading down the Shelikov, and I look behind me to the starboard stern, and there's a big white boat back there. And I think there's some of you guys out here that are familiar with those big white boats with the orange stripe on it. It was a Storrs. And so I quickly wake up Brian. He's sleeping in the wheelhouse, and I said, "Brian, you know, there's a big white boat over there." And he says, "Okay, check the radio." Well, we had turned down the radio, so we had turned up the radio. That's not a good thing. And the Coast Guard promptly found out that we turned up the radio, and they said, "We'd like to board." So they came and they boarded us. And I really love the Coast Guard. I actually even have a friend that's in the Coast Guard. he might be here. I only have one friend that's in the Coast Guard. But anyway, when these guys come and board, they have 9mm guns on their side. You know, it's not a friendly situation. And so they boarded, and you're kind of nervous, but that went fine, and we were all compliant, and so that was done. We're motoring off to White Bay, which is on the Alaska Peninsula, pretty far south. We get down there, drop the gear, and start hauling gear to get our halibut, and we're not getting halibut. We're pulling up sharks, and we're pulling up cod, and we're pulling up a lot of ice on the bow of the boat. It's cold. It's like 20 below, and it's blowing, and this freezing spray is getting on the boat. And when you pull up a shark just wraps the line around itself, and it's all tangled up, and it's just a big mess. And so Brian says, "We're getting out of here. We got to go further out to sea where it's warmer." And the weather's starting to come up a little bit. It's probably blowing about 35, and we turned to head south and west, and all of a sudden the life raft is deployed. And there's our life raft floating in the ocean, and we're going the other way, and Brian, being a good captain, calls us all up to the wheelhouse and says, "Hey, we need to have a meeting here." And he turns to the two young men that are crew on the boat, and you might know that one was Chuck Norris and the other one was Jason Bourne. You know, they're 19 and 21 years old, and so when he asks them, Do you think we should go back for the life raft?" They say, "We don't need no stinking life raft." And then he turns to the other middle-aged person on the boat, and I'm thinking, okay, here's the chance. come on, Kip, you can answer this for me. And Kip says, yeah, we could probably get by without it. You know, no big deal. We probably injured somebody pulling it on board anyway. So now Brian turns to me, the greenhorn banker, and I want this life raft in the boat. I want this life raft. And so I think, how can I say to Brian that I want this life raft without being a weenie? And so I say, Brian, I'm going to defer to your wise and expert 20-year experience as a skipper. You know the right thing to do, and I'm going to depend on that. And so Brian thinks about 4 seconds and says, let's leave it. And, and we motor our way, and I'm looking at this life raft, and the strobe on the top is blinking, and I'm thinking, that's my chance. That's my chance. It's going away. And finally, after about 5 minutes, Brian thinks, he says, you know, I think we better go back and get it. So we go back and get it, which made me feel really good. I say, oh, thank you, Lord. And so we head south, and now we get on some grounds and lay down the gear, and we're going to get ready to pull it, and the whales show up. And so now we got to run a long time. We run 10 hours north to Cherkov Island to hide behind the island because the weather's now blowing about 55. And then we run 10 hours back to get to the gear, and thankfully the whales have gone somewhere else. There has been a party at the bottom of the ocean, and all the halibut have jumped on our hooks, and we're hauling fish, and it's a fabulous day. And have you ever been on a boat, and when you're hauling fish, it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And so the weather doesn't mean anything. It's just money time. We caught about 35,000 pounds, and we're headed for home. And so we're getting closer to the Sitka, and the weather's getting worse. And now it's blowing 70 knots, which is about 80 miles an hour. The boat is starting to go over like this, and then we're crawling back up the waves like this. And I'm going like this, and I'm kicking my foot out like this, so I don't fall into Brian in the wheelhouse. And it's getting bad. And then I look over at Brian, and all of a sudden he's looking at a wave coming from my left, and he says, oh, shit! And the wave, huge wave, crashes into the boat, T-bones the wave wall, it's bent in, and halibut gears all over the back deck. And then, you know, all of this, and he says, okay, guys, you get out on the deck and clean that up. I'm thinking, what is he thinking? He cares more about that gear than he cares about me and the other crew. And he said, Mark, you don't go out on deck. I think he knew what he was talking about. He said, you stay at the galley window and watch those guys, make sure we don't lose anybody. So that was my role for a minute. So the guys get cleaned up, and we get back inside the wheelhouse, and it's getting really bad. And then Brian says, okay, everybody, up in the wheelhouse, we got to tell sea stories. And the sea stories are just, I've learned now, just a distraction. So, anyway, we made it back, obviously. We had a great time. We ended up making up t-shirts for ourselves that said, Real Men Fish 3B in November. And our wives said, you should have put Real Men, Real Stupid Men Fish 3B in November. But, I wish Ron was still here, because I'd go fishing with him again. I wouldn't go to 3B in November with him again, but I would go with him again. And you've all seen this boat, and if you haven't seen it before, you'll see it when you walk out tonight, because it's on the back wall. It's the lucky lady that we were on. Thank you.
Our next storyteller is Mary Lukens. She was born in California, but her family moved when she was school age to Hawaii, and she graduated from Kailua High School. She taught in villages in rural Alaska for 9 years in the 80s and 90s, and came to Kodiak after getting her master's in counseling at UAA in 2000 for a combined village and high school counseling job. She retired 2.5 years ago and loves travel, kayaking, hiking, and unusual adventures.
I lived 2 years in Lyon Village, population 28, eight students. There was no water, no electricity, a shortwave radio in the school, and there was one male plane a week from McGrath, about an hour's drive away, or flight away. Margaret, who was a sister of three of my students, and I decided we were going to go on a sled dog trip down to visit her sister and brother-in-law about 30 miles down the Stony River. So we borrowed dogs and a sled from her parents, and I had been running four dogs all winter, so we just took a couple extra dogs, and we put sleeping bag in the sled and took turns, got down about dusk to the cabin, and they were so happy to see us, because if you ever live 24/7 in a small cabin with two people, any visitor is welcome. So we had fun, and on Sunday, a trapper came by and let John know that the weather was going to change. It was going to get 40 below that night, and it was going to stay for 3 or 4 days. And Margaret and I looked at each other and went, well, there goes our Monday trip. I think we better get going. So we harnessed up the dogs, we said our goodbyes, and we headed up river towards Lyme. Well, about the first 2 hours, everything went fine. The dogs were running nicely, except the swing dogs were turning around a lot and looking at the sled. And the way we had the dogs set up, they didn't have necklines. So they had a lot of freedom. And I didn't really notice anything too unusual, so I didn't think about it. And the next hour, they kept doing that. The swing dogs kept turning around. And so I thought, well, I better study this team, see what's going on. And then I saw it. The right wheel dog was cheating. He was running just fast enough to have a slack harness and no weight. And the dogs knew it. And I decided, well, better stop and change positions for the dogs, because, you know, this was not good. So as Margaret was staking out the dogs, two of them turned around and attacked the wheel dog. So there was growling and snapping, and the other five, you know, all the five dogs jumped in the front. I mean, what's a dog fight without all the dogs? So they all fought, and the wheel dog was on the bottom. There was snapping of jaws and growling, and Margaret and I were trying to yell at each other directions. She was trying to pull the dogs one way. I was trying to pull the wheel dog out from underneath. Blood was spurting out of his chest with puncture wounds, and I was trying to pull him, finally unhooked him, pulled him out from the snow, and there was a big red slick all the way. So I took my white scarf, which I did bring tonight, I've kept it all along, and put snow in it and wrapped it around his body twice and tucked it in while Margaret was trying to contain the dogs. And she was having the hardest time. So I went over and tried to help her. The wheel dog was like down for the count right now. And we had to take every harness off and redo the lines and get it straightened out. Well, by that time was ticking on, and it was already dusk. It had been an hour since we stopped, and we knew we were going to get to Lyme in the dark anyway when we started out in the afternoon, but this was going on a little further than we thought. So we finally got them straightened out, and we thought, okay, we're ready to go. We got to put the wheel dog in the sled with somebody, and we did that, and we thought, okay, we're ready. Well, the dogs went, no, you're not. We're not going anywhere with this nemesis in the sled. We are not hauling that dog. It did nothing for the whole, you know, rest of the trip. So they wouldn't go. They wouldn't move. And it didn't matter what we did, they would not move. And so we sat there and went, okay, what do we do now? You know, it's getting about 25 below. It's getting dusk. So I finally, in desperation, went up in front of the team and pulled the lead dogs along. Well, trying to pull five uncooperative dogs
and a heavy sled up a trail in 30 below temperature is not easy. And I'm gonna go over, I'm lying. anyway, so I did that for an hour, and I was wet and sweaty, and I was cold, and we had about 12 miles left to go. And Margaret and I looked at each other and went, we are not getting home tonight if we don't figure out a different strategy. So we left Margaret and the dog by the side of the river, picked up a bunch of wood, put it next to her, gave her the sleeping bag, and I was to go up to Lyme with the dogs and get her cousin Joe and a snow machine, come back down and get her. Well, by that time, it was pitch dark. But as soon as the dogs saw there wasn't a dog in the sled, they just started running. And I didn't have my scarf, so my face was all frozen. And my eyes were sealing shut with crystals, you know. I couldn't see anything, it was dark. I had a little flashlight, I was trying to, you know, see the trail. I thought, the dogs know how to get home. So they actually did. They set a good pace, they got there in 2 hours. I found Joe up river with his snow machine. He wasn't in his cabin. We gave the dogs up. We got a sled and some gas and some blankets. And I pulled a scarf from his grandfather and said, I need this. And we jumped on the snow machine and went down the river about 3 hours after I'd left Margaret. By the time we saw the fire down the river, it was probably midnight and probably about 40 below. And Margaret was shaking uncontrollably. There was no wood left in the pile that we collected. We bundled her up with blankets with a dog. We put her in the sled. I jumped on the back of the snow machine and we went haul ass all the way up to Lyme. Now, the dog survived, but the team never allowed him to be in the line anymore. Dogs have long memories. And every time we try and hook him up, no matter what position, they always growled at him and just stood there. I always have wondered since then what Margaret was thinking when I left her in 40 below on the side of a river in the middle of nowhere with a wounded dog. And she was waiting for help, and she was trusting that I would get back there for her. So we never talked about it. I never told this story before, but the fates must have been with us because we made it and we were safe, but anything could have happened on that river. 40 below, leaving someone in the middle of nowhere. But we were lucky, and or the gods were with us that night, so.
Our last storyteller for tonight is Lacey Jane Brewster. Lacey was born in Gresham, Oregon, and made the trek up the Alcan when she was 19. And moved to Kodiak 1 year ago today when she transferred work offices from Palmer. When she's not working, she likes running and hiking with her dog and attempting to slay fish. One bizarre detail that she has is that I have a three-legged cat. August of 2007 with the boy. And go figure, by about March, things weren't going that hot, and I had dipped back out to Oregon. But I was only there for about a week when I decided that my calling was in Alaska and I was gonna go back. So I'm on the internet, on Craigslist, trying to find a place to live, because I wasn't gonna go look at the dude again. And I find a little cabin, $375 a month, and it's dry. And I'm like, I can do dry cabin, I'm young. Everybody else I know does it. So I'll do this dry cabin thing. So I come back to Alaska,
from my little cabin. And the first thing I found out about this cabin was that it wasn't really a cabin. It was a sauna. And the guy who I was renting it from had literally taken some 2x4s on the sauna benches and added them on so you could put a mattress on them. And I was like, okay, well, that wasn't what I was expecting, but it's $375 a month. What are you going to do? So then I look at him and I'm like, okay, well, so where's the outhouse? And he's like,
there is no outhouse. It's a dry cabin.
I'm like, dude, yeah, I know it's a dry cabin. That's why I'm asking what the outhouse is. And he's like, there's no outhouse. Well, that sucks. And the guy, you know, how romance goes, we're kind of still seeing each other, and he brought me over this nice vase of yellow roses. And I don't know why he got yellow, because that's for friendship. Everybody knows red is for love, and that was a dumb move. But I'll tell you what I did with those flowers. I got rid of them, and I kept the vase. I'll let y'all imagine what I did with that vase. So a few years later, my lease had run on my sauna. I'm in Fairbanks now, in my senior year of college, and living in a dry cabin again, but this one had an outhouse. And like a proper dry cabin and a proper outhouse, the outhouse is a good 75 meters from the cabin, because you don't put your outhouse by your cabin because that's gross. And no offense to y'all here in Kodiak, but as far as Alaska is concerned, it's fairly warm here. Fairbanks is a little different. And so when winter hits, and it comes down to the question of whether or not I want to walk to that outhouse in 40 below, or just kind of sneak to the side of the cabin and do my business over there, sneaking to the side of the cabin seemed like a good idea. And I wasn't the only one that was living there or visiting there who also thought it was a good idea. So by the time breakup comes, I don't really know any other way to put it, but there was a small pea pond that had developed on the side of our cabin. It wasn't pretty. And I just remember looking at the gentleman I was with and being like, you know, probably shouldn't do that next year. So a few years later in my life, I'm living with running water, and I'm in Buffalo, New York. I had to take this exam. It's called the bar. And the bar is like a hard exam or something. And it's a couple days long, and it's nice. They give you a lunch break. And so what's important here is there's like four times where the bathroom situation happens. And as I think some of you here might have seen, when you get a room full or a group full of people that are men and women, this common thing happens in the place that they're all at. The women's room forms this long line, and the men's room is just empty. I don't understand why, but this is a thing that happens. And I was taking a bar in Buffalo, New York, and Buffalo, it's like a big deal when this exam happens. Probably something like at least 1,000 people are there just to take the test. They shut down the roads, there's cops on horses making sure that we're not getting run over, food carts are outside, lots of people are there. And I just want to preface this little story with this small historic fact about a case from 1873 from the United States Supreme Court, it's called Brattle versus Illinois, where our lovely Supreme Court held that a woman does not have the right to sit for the bar exam. So that kind of was not a good thing for ladies back then. Fast forward to 2016, and we're now in a situation where women can sit for the bar exam, and there's so much of us that the bathroom situation is happening. And it's the beginning of the exam, and you've studied for months, and everybody's really stressed out. And given the group of people that's sitting for this test, rules are kind of important. And one of the biggest rules is that you have to be in your seat at 9 o'clock. When the test starts. And so I'm standing in line in the bathroom. I think I'm on the second edge of the loop around, and I'm looking over at the men's room. I really gotta pee. I really gotta be in my seat at 9 o'clock. And I'm thinking to myself, what am I going to do? I can't not pee. So I think to myself, you know what? I'm the girl with the pee pond and the pee base. I can do the men's room. So I put my head down and I go in. I go into no woman's land. And let me tell you, ladies, what it was like in there. It was crazy. There's a bunch of dudes. They're all standing on the side in the back. And they're just doing their thing. And the stalls were all empty. I couldn't believe it. So I wasn't the only woman who got this bright idea. And I started the exam and everything goes great. By lunchtime, the bar exam people were like, yeah, we got this problem with the bathrooms. So you know what they did? They put a janitor in front of one of the men's rooms and turned it into a ladies' room. So then we all got to witness the beautiful sight of watching the men wait. They stood in line, just like us. And it was a great thing, because in 1873, they said we couldn't sit for that exam, and now we're taking your bathroom. The next morning, they designated us the bathroom again. By lunch, they forgot to send a nice person to get us the ladies' room, but I'm happy to report that the men learned, and we just kept that bathroom. So when it comes down to the question of whether or not you're gonna go, go. Thank you everyone for coming to the Whether or Not Galley Table Story Show. Let's give another round of applause to our storytellers. And to Ryan Phelps, our musician. Please join us next month on the second Friday of April. The theme is Wild One. And thank you.
Galley Table Storytelling is made possible through a partnership with the Kodiak Arts Council and Kodiak Public Broadcasting Corporation. Visit us online at galleytables.com to find the date and location of the next live storytelling event. You can also browse our archives and listen to past stories or sign up to be a storyteller. Galley Tables, sharing stories and sharing life. Thank you.